You're listening to an interview with Jesse Rosenfeld at CKUT. I'm Niusha Bastani, and I'll be hosting this interview. Jesse Rosenfeld is a Canadian journalist based in the Middle East since 2007. His work has been published with The Nation, The Guardian, Al Jazeera English, Le Monde Diplomatique, Electric Intifada, and The Daily Beast, among others. He is the focus of Santiago Bertolino's latest documentary film, Freelancer on the Frontlines, which follows his journey as he covers the Egyptian Revolution, the 2014 Gaza War, the reality of refugee camps in Turkey, and the progress of Kurdish fighters against Daesh. Freelancer on the Frontlines is featured in the Montreal International Documentary Festival this year. In the first part of this interview, you will also hear from the director of the film, Santiago Bertolino, who will be speaking in French. I want to begin by asking you if you could tell me a bit about how this film came to be and how you two met and decided to make this.
Ouais. Donc c'est ça, j'ai rencontré Jesse en 2010 sur le bateau canadien pour Gaza, qui était une action d'activistes pro-palestiniens qui voulaient prendre un bateau pour se rendre jusqu'à la bande de Gaza pour essayer de briser le blocus symboliquement, en apportant aussi de l'aide humanitaire. Sur le bateau, il y avait des pacifistes, mais il y avait aussi des journalistes qui avaient été invités à documenter cette action militante-là. Et j'ai rencontré Jesse. Et Jesse, il se démarquait un peu des autres journalistes mainstream parce qu'il faisait du journalisme plus engagé socialement. Puis je m'étais rendu compte qu'il était il comprenait vraiment bien la réalité des militants sur le bateau. Puis ensuite, il m'a raconté qu'il était basé à Ramallah, puis qu'il faisait beaucoup de journalisme à travers tout le Moyen-Orient, puis qu'il réussissait progressivement à vivre de journalisme. Alors, en me parlant, je me suis rendu compte que c'était vraiment intéressant la vie qu'il vivait, puis à travers lui, je pourrais en même temps documenter toute la politique du Moyen-Orient. Donc, 2 ans plus tard, je me suis remémoré ce que faisait Jesse, puis je l'ai appelé. Puis on a discuté, puis Jesse a dit, OK, viens me rencontrer à Ramallah. Puis on a commencé le film comme ça.
Yeah, well, as Santiago was just saying, we met when I was covering the second flotilla to Gaza that was intended to leave from Greece and reach the shores of blockaded Gaza, got blocked in Greece. I was reporting it for Now magazine. And then a few years later, we actually met when I was covering the Quebec student strikes in 2012 back in Montreal. And a few months later, I got a phone call from him in Ramallah saying, hey, I'd like to do a film about journalism today and, find a way of looking at that point, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and the occupation, because that was where I was based at the time. And then he came, and we did a shoot in Ramallah, and then soon after that, I moved to Egypt, and he just sort of followed me around for 3 years. And that was how the movie got made. I mean, my interest in doing it was that, and I think you see in the film, there is a sort of subtext of a theme that connects the various different places that we're covering and connects a kind of narrative of what the region's going through in terms of this period of counter-revolution and stagnation. And for me, the interest in doing the film was a way of giving a second life to the stories that I had been covering and that I'm writing about. You'll notice that if you look at the articles I wrote during those periods of the trip, it covers a different side and different stories, some that you couldn't get to with the camera lens. But at the same time, for me, the interest was I struggled to write the images that you can capture with a camera from places that most people in the world don't see. And the documentary was an opportunity to show what those images looked like and show what those places looked like and show those stories through a different framework to a different audience.
And I definitely want to ask you more about the Middle East specifically in a little bit, but I want to backtrack first and ask you, Jesse, so before you ended up being a freelancer based in the Middle East, you worked for the McGill Daily, which is a newspaper based in McGill here. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if you could talk a bit about how you went from a student journalist to where you are now.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I did my undergrad at McGill, and I was a news editor at the Daily in my final year and wrote for the Daily throughout. And really, in many ways, that sort of set me up for the kind of journalism that I'm doing. And politically, as a student, the issues I was most engaged in were in opposition to the Iraq War and supporting the Palestinian struggle for self-determination, like in Middle East politics. And then I was also writing about community issues in Montreal, the student movement and political issues as they arose on campus for the Daily. And then when I graduated, I just sort of figured, you know, put two and two together and moved to Ramallah a few months after graduating and started freelancing. Now, I did that at a point when this was 2007 before the economic collapse, just several months before, when there was still the idea of a promise of a job and that freelancing wouldn't be an entire way of life, but rather something that you could do and then get a correspondent job with a publication. And since I've gotten to the Middle East, all you've seen, you see this across the media, is that those jobs get eliminated, they don't get replaced, and the entire reliance is on freelance. And here we are today.
So you both mentioned this idea of being socially engaged as a journalist. I'm wondering, do you two see journalism as a form of activism?
Je crois que, ouais, je fais des documentaires quand même engagés socialement, c'est-à-dire que je vais prendre position, mais souvent, la manière que je vais prendre position, c'est à travers mes personnages. Donc, j'ai choisi Jesse parce que, justement, il y avait une forme de journalisme un peu plus engagée. Et ça permet aussi, en même temps, de créer une comparaison avec les journalistes plus mainstream, où est-ce la sorte de journaliste où est-ce qu'on fait plus de journalisme objectif. À travers Jesse, on peut aussi se permettre une espèce de réflexion sur l'engagement aussi dans le monde, l'importance de prendre position dans le monde du journalisme.
And for me, no.
Is that that?
For example, the McGill Daily Statement of Principles is something that's still very influential in how I see how journalism needs to be done. I think you know, we got it right pretty early. But in terms of being a form of activism, journalism is the search for truth. Activism is what you do with the truth. And for me, I want people to react to my stories, to see what's going on, and to have the information that they need to act politically. But I'm not the one that's telling them how to act. I'm not the one that's organizing them. And I fundamentally believe the role of what good journalism does is it highlights what is happening, who is affected, how they feel about it, how they react, why they react, and who is responsible. And with that information, people should be informed as to, and have an understanding of what's going on and how they can act accordingly based on where they are in receiving that information. And that's what I think my role as a journalist primarily is.
I wanted to ask you about the time you've spent reporting in Israel and occupied Palestine. So there's a really striking scene in the movie where you're driving on the apartheid road. I'm wondering if you could talk about this jarring inequality that's encompassed in the apartheid road, the apartheid wall, that I think really comes out in your coverage of the 2014 Gaza war in the movie.
So yeah, I've been based in Israel-Palestine since 2007. I lived primarily in Ramallah in the occupied West Bank. Lived for a while in Tel Aviv and Jaffa, spent the war living in Gaza. And it's interesting that you pointed to media in 2014, because that was really the year that the coverage of the discussion of Palestine shifted. We were able to report things from Gaza City in terms of the Palestinian experience and its third Gaza war with this complete onslaught, and what it was that people were, why people were determined to continue to fight if they thought it was going to end the blockade and the siege, and to tell those stories in an unvarnished way in the mainstream U.S. press that you'd have trouble expressing in the left-wing and progressive press in 2008. That same stuff. So there was a shift that went on. Yeah, I mean, the scene with the highway, it's interesting because it's Highway 443. It is the alternate route between Tel Aviv and Jerusalem that cuts right through the West Bank. Now, it also connects with all the villages with nearby Ramallah, and there have actually been even court cases at Israel's own Supreme Court that have been won saying that Palestinians with Palestinian-plated cars should be allowed to, within a Palestinian area, drive on this road. Despite the law, the checkpoint is still fully in place, and while in theory a Palestinian car can drive on this road, in practice, they never are. And so it is a sign of the enforced segregation for the continuity and flow of the Israeli public and Israeli territory. And so it's unique because it's not like a settler road that's kind of out connecting two settlements in the northern West Bank that, you know, is a way of avoiding Nablus or whatever. This is a road that connects two of Israel's most important cities, and it cuts right through the heart of the West Bank, and it is militarily segregated. And it is, in that sense, a expression of the kind of permanence of the Israeli system as it currently exists, and Israel's intention to not have it as an indefinite temporary system, but as a structurally permanent one.
Could you tell me a bit more about this shift that you think happened in terms of coverage? Do you feel that's part of like a bigger ongoing trend?
Yeah, I mean, there were several factors that I think went into it. Firstly, with the plethora of media that's out there, the debate around Israel has been forced open more. Organizations like Electronic Intifada have been very effective in using new mediums to compete with the kind of breadth and determination of a lot of the pro-Israel organizations that lobby the media. And they've been able to put out a Palestinian perspective within the West. And, you know, and activist groups have done this increasingly so. But also, in Gaza during the war, you had every major journalist from every major network all getting bombed together, seeing that for themselves that there's nowhere to run. And everyone's fixer has family that they, you know, they wonder whether their family are going to survive the night while they're out helping you get onto a rooftop to see what's going on. So, I mean, everyone felt the war. And because in terms of political shifts, the certain amount of daylight or frustration that people in Washington were hearing because of the frustration of the Obama administration started to ripple through when their correspondents in the Middle East said, hey, this is going on. They just bombed a UN school. We saw the rubble. We saw where the missiles came from. We saw the families screaming. We can see clearly how this process is not only happening and how it's being enabled, but the political cynicism of it. And when that all came around and broke through into the 24-hour news cycle, there was a certain reality that you couldn't stop looking at. And we're not talking opinion. We're talking about a reporting of what the experience of living under an Israeli war in a place that is besieged and occupied. It was astonishing to actually be able to, for the first time, break through and tell in the U.S. mainstream press. Yeah, I think the way that people see that war is fundamentally different than the way that they see other Israeli wars, and that was a breaking point for many people, is because of that reality of what changed and what we were allowed to see of the war.
There's another scene in the movie, which actually isn't in Palestine, but it's at a refugee camp where you're talking to someone who is basically talking about how they think all journalists are liars.
Oh, yeah, the guy was telling me to go fuck a donkey.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So how do you navigate that kind of resistance where people very reasonably have a mistrust of journalists?
I mean, you try to understand it, and it's completely understandable. If you're living in a refugee, and he was a Kurdish refugee in the camps on the Turkish side of the border, just overwatching Kobani as the battle for Kobani raged, he could step out of his tent into, a muddied ground where, he had absolutely nothing, and look a few kilometers away and watch the billows of smoke from what is his village being pummeled in a battle that no one was doing anything about except, the Kurds were fighting on their own. And his frustration was that no matter who he told his story to, and you see this all the time, and no matter how many times he went through it, and no matter what he said or what anyone around him said, his situation got worse. For him, what's the point in telling? People tell their stories because they hope that when people hear their story, people take action and do something about their lives. And when your only experience is other people coming, hearing what you have to say, but nothing changing, it's an incredibly frustrating experience.
So you mentioned Kobani in your answer. I wanted to ask about what you think is being undercovered by mainstream press in the Middle East right now.
Well, I mean, the Syrian Kurdish struggle is one of those things that's very difficult to cover. Getting in to Rojava is a very difficult process, especially since the Kurdistan Regional Government in Northern Iraq has closed their access points from Iraq to the Kurds there. So there has been a lot written on it. The Kurdish story, I think the Kurdish story that is more undercovered is the situation in southeast Turkey. And last year in March, I was in southeast Turkey, in Diyarbakir, and I was the first foreign journalist into Cizre after the Turks had obliterated it with tank shelling to a way that actually looked like a lot of streets I saw in Gaza City during the war. And what you have is the government engaged in a total Israeli occupation style of repression accelerated by a counterinsurgency war being fought in the Kurdish cities across the southeast. And we don't talk about that. And the story that I wrote, we went into Cizre, we saw, you know, where people had been blown up, you know, where families were huddling in basements and they had been incinerated. And the connection with Syria is that people in southeast Turkey look at the YPG and they think, well, the YPG has been successful in carving out territory where Kurds can decide for themselves, regardless of the bitter conditions they face around them. That's going to be our only response to Turkey, a country that doesn't want to actually negotiate a federalized system or any sense of Kurdish self-determination. And so, I mean, that story in The Mess of Everything is one that, yeah, increasingly gets lost. It's also because it's hard to access. I mean, so we would, you know, we saw what went on in Cizre. Then we went and talked to the PKK behind their barricades in Nusaybin, which is another city on the Syrian border. But talking to the people on the front lines of a guerrilla urban insurgency is a very difficult process to mass cover anyway. However, because of the news of Syria, which is completely justifiable, and the horror that's happening there, because of Erdogan's own maneuvering in Ankara, there are so many other monumentously politically consequential places and hotspots surrounding everything that's happening in the southeast, that story gets lost in the blaze of fire that surrounds it.
Another thing I wanted to ask about is a scene in the film where you see Stephen Harper talking about his plan for Canada's involvement in the Middle East. And then later in the film, you also talk about people not understanding their responsibility mm-hmm. in terms of everything going on there. What role do you see the media playing in making that connection clear?
I think that's the media's responsibility. It's that you have to honestly reflect what is happening to your audience in a way that they can, at the very least, relate on the very basis of human solidarity with the people. That they see, that they can understand this is what other people go through and have some sense of an ability to connect to that. Now, more importantly, that people who watch the media understand who is responsible for these situations and who the actors at play are. And they know who to direct their responses to. That's also the importance of the media. But now more than ever, I mean, one of the things that technology has made very easy is that you can get the who, the what, and the where very quickly. From a press conference, you don't need to be there. You're going to get within 2 minutes a note, you know, all the notes on Twitter or all the notes dispatched out by the wires that say, you know, this general made this proclamation in this place and said this happened. But you have a lot more time when you're watching that happen on your phone to sit in a cafe in the place that is, you know, that the general has either just bombed or, you know, the place that the general is from and ask people what they think and get a whole other level of a perspective on what's going on with the time that you've saved because technology has made information fly that much faster. And I think that's a task of journalism today, is to take that time to actively go in to express the multiple dimensions of the societies that your report, you know, that are being covered and the context in which this news and these events are happening and get that to their readers. I think very interested to see the way that Canadians react to this film and, you know, whether they do go see it. And that I think it sparks some very important issues for Canadians to address about themselves. They're going to see a lot of stories in there that they don't read in their own newspapers, but were being written for the mainstream U.S. press. And there is a particular kind of isolation that Canada lives in terms of the English language press that's separated from the rest of the world. Canadians use to insulate themselves and distance themselves from reality that their country is very much a part of. And I hope what this sparks is a question about why they're not hearing about these issues and what needs to change in their own media and their own society to actually see themselves as part of the world and necessarily engage accordingly.